try to reduce carbon.
So there are ways to do that. Any of us believe are helpful and probably are unhelpful.
It's another response in the carbon debate that's happening because the marketplace demands it, because it's good business. You don't necessarily need the government to come in.
Hi, this is Dr. Bud Pearson. Welcome to Oregon Crossroads. And the goal of our Crossroads session is to talk about important issues of our day. And remember, we're always about freedom and prosperity, how we can be more free and how we can be more prosperous. And today, at least to start off, we're going to be talking about an important issue, which is reduction in carbon or greenhouse gases. And today, as a guest, I'm quite honored to have J.L. Wilson. And J.L. is a phenomenal person who has worked in government affairs for much of his life. And J.L. really supports the idea of freedom and prosperity and some limitation in government powers. Now, I know some people are comfortable and uncomfortable with this, but you have to agree that there is no more powerful entity in America than our government, federal, state, local. And if you look at our executive branch, legislative branch, and our judicial branch, they are powerful. And they have great people, many of them are trying to do the right thing, but when you get that powerful, they have to do some checks. And J.L. has been very involved in the process of promoting freedom and prosperity, but also let's keep that government a little bit tapped down so it doesn't completely overwhelm us in our daily lives. So that's kind of the background. And I do want to start off with a little bit of a contentious topic, I think, that in society today, that has to do with carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm a huge believer in science. I have a PhD. I have a medical degree and a PhD. And a PhD, I spent 6 years learning how to be a scientist. And I was a better doctor than a scientist, so I became a doctor, a physician. But what you learn is a couple things when you go through that kind of training. One is science never proves anything. What science does is it takes the latest available evidence and comes to a consensus or a statement of where we're at that time. The whole field and the idea can change with the next experiment. So you do have to hang on to something. So where science is important, but don't think of it as proof. The question is over. There's always another question. There's always another experiment. And real science is done by having a hypothesis or an idea and trying to disprove it. So if you really believe that human activity is a fundamental driver of climate change, then you should be on the side of trying to disprove that to convince yourself that it's true. And if you're on the side that human activity isn't the main driver in climate change, you should be trying to come up with ideas and experiments that you believe make your idea wrong so that you can believe it more. So rather than rigging the experiments to fit your idea, you should be trying to disprove it. That's the first rule in doing real scientific experiments. Now, I do believe in consensus and national organizations. Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, was very concerned about scientific input into public policy. And he formed the National Academy of Sciences. And when I was at UC Riverside, we had 0 members of the National Academy of Sciences. And we had 1 member promoted to that organization and asked to join. You have to be asked. You don't get paid. When you're assigned to that organization, your institution pays your usual compensation, but you can be called upon to serve for the government's best interest. And it's a certain term of service. So this is as least a biased organization as we can have. So I have the summary statement on carbon emissions from the United States National Academy of Sciences and the British Royal Society. And this is probably our best statement at this point in time. Again, it could change tomorrow if there's a new scientific study, but this is where we are. Summary. This document explains that there are well understood physical mechanisms by which changes in the amounts of greenhouse gases cause climate changes. It discusses the evidence that the concentration of these gases in the atmosphere have increased and are still increasing rapidly, that climate change is occurring, and that most of the recent change is almost certainly due to emissions of greenhouse gases caused by human activities. Further climate change is inevitable if emissions of greenhouse gases continue unabated. Future changes will substantially exceed those that have occurred so far. there remains a range of estimates of the magnitude and regional expression of future change, but increases in the extremes of climate that can adversely affect natural ecosystems and human activities and infrastructure are expected. This is written by scientists. As you tell, lots of uncertainty, but they do state that we likely should take this seriously and that we should try to reduce carbon. So there are ways to do that. There are ways that many of us believe are helpful and probably are unhelpful. So I'm gonna now turn it over to JL, who's been involved in this carbon approach, at least from a government level, let him comment a little bit. And let me see what JL thinks about a bad approach or a good approach. Just take it from there. What do you think, JL?
Well, I think the first thing, industry doesn't get enough credit for what it's done to date to reduce carbon emissions. I've represented manufacturing interests. I'm a big believer in manufacturing. I think that entire communities are built on manufacturing, making things, importing the wealth. And I think the thing you want to avoid is deindustrializing and curbing production activity because you're in essence making a conscious decision to become poorer. And I don't think that's in anybody's interest. So that's the lens that I look at this carbon debate through. And I think that you've seen industries take proactive steps because the market has demanded it. Consumers have demanded it. And so whereas 18, 19 years ago, we had as a state about 72, 73 million metric tons of carbon emissions, given all that economic activity and growth over the past 20 years, we're down to 62, 63 million. So there's been an actual concrete reduction in carbon emissions given all the economic growth in the state over the past 20 years. So something good is clearly happening. Steps are being taken. I think that there are certainly folks who think that that pace needs to be accelerated and that we need to go beyond that. I think that I'm a big believer in executive leadership. I don't think that punitive measures work, or I think that they're counterproductive. I get back to that notion of consciously making a choice to be poorer by curbing economic activity. And I believe we got to avoid those outcomes. So the cap and trade proposal and pricing carbon is on the table today. And basically what you're saying is we're going to tax you for emitting carbon. And if you put those signals in the marketplace, you're going to curb growth automatically. Who's going to produce more when more production yields a greater cost, a greater tax in the production? And I don't think there's any doubt that as those costs get passed through, and they're passed through in three primary ways, because our carbon emissions are really manifest in our transportation fuels, they're manifest in your electricity and your natural gas. The vast majority of carbon emissions are in those three buckets. I know people like to think of it as coming out of a smokestack and things like that. That's probably 6 to 8% of total emissions is through the industrial process. When you talk about increasing those costs, you're talking about raising the cost of living on people of modest and middle income means, and that's counterproductive. You're making Oregon unaffordable to drive and to get yourself places, to heat your home, to turn on the lights and to cook and do all those things that we all do every day. And so those are very regressive costs. And the first thing you're going to have to do is how do you mitigate those costs? And I just think that is the wrong way to go. And that's, in addition to curbing economic activity. So getting back to my thoughts on being a believer in executive leadership, I've represented the food industry for many years. I know as a case in point, they took it upon themselves to produce initiatives throughout their industry to reduce carbon emissions, to increase energy efficiency, and do those things that they knew were sustainable and good for the industry, good for the environment, good for their consumers. And nobody needed to tell them to do that. They did that on their own. But even if there weren't industries that were proactive, like the food producers, if this was an initiative of the governor, the legislature, or our state leaders, I think that there's an opportunity for partnership and for leadership that doesn't necessarily need the punitive hand of government to come in and extract wealth out of the private sector and create these big pots of money for people to seek, because that's effectively what happens. And so if this was a major initiative, you know, in the strategic plan of the state, that this is what we were going to do, I don't see a problem with executive attention and executive focus on that, but that creates a need for outreach and partnership and a proactivity to get into the business sectors and seek to partner with them to do these types of things. I think that there's a lot of power in persuasion, a lot of power in partnership that does not need the heavy hand of government to extract wealth as sort of the stick. And so I would like to see that approach. I think you see a lot of best available control technologies in the marketplace today for these types of things. But I think that partnership, while those technologies gets developed, is probably the right way to go. And it sends a signal to industry that we want you here. I can't tell you how self-defeating it is to increase the cost of electricity and natural gas and transportation fuel if you want to attract manufacturing and production activity in this state. Because just remember, Oregon's energy mix is probably has the lowest carbon intensity of any state in the country already, save the state of Washington. So you're telling me that to increase those inputs for an industrial enterprise and push them into the Southeast or the Midwest, where the carbon intensity of their energy supply is far greater, that is a bad environmental outcome. And it's a bad economic outcome, because then you're going to make them reliant on energy sources that have far more carbon intensity in the Midwest or Southeast. We want to bring them here. I mean, the message should be, if you want to be good for the environment, because we've got low carbon energy already, it's because we've got a heavy reliance on hydro, we need to bring people here. They need to bring their production activity in Oregon. And so I feel like the messages that we're sending are not only economically adverse, but they are environmentally adverse. Because you know we've got the lowest carbon intensity, so we should be, the environmentally conscious decision is to attract that activity in Oregon. But I feel like we're setting up roadblocks instead.
Very good. So to emphasize those main points, it turns out that Oregon is a very low emitter of carbon already. I think I was reading something like 0.01%, but a very low number. An inconsequential number to the world's carbon production.
It's about 0.1%.
Okay, 0.1%. So inconsequential to the world's production of greenhouse gases. That in fact, if energy intensive or more intensive industries are centered here, because our energy has such a low carbon production, you actually end up producing products with a less carbon cost to the world's environment. And remember that Oregon is part of the world's environment. It isn't, we don't have a bubble around us, so this is just Oregon. So if we want to improve the cleanliness of the world's atmosphere, we would move manufacturing into Oregon using our mix of energy. And in fact, if you look at where the problem lies, if you really believe that, well, if you believe the National Academy of Sciences and you want to lower carbon and greenhouse gas emissions, the poorer countries have to produce less greenhouse emissions, because it turns out until about 2006, America was at the leading carbon producer, and now we're being far outstripped by China. India's moving up. And if you look at the Western world, carbon production is slowly going down due to many of these initiatives of industry, because people that live here want to have a great environment. That's part of being American and Oregonian. And in the third world, they're just poor. They're just poor. And if you, in fact, want to help people to clean up their environment, help them be affluent. And again, by making ourselves poorer, that doesn't help us to clean up the problem. In fact, industries that need to have resources, that need to have margin to to clean themselves up. If you tax that margin and send it to government coffers, they don't even have the money to clean up their industry, and that takes money. And so it doesn't even make sense. So it doesn't make sense. This morning I was driving in, and I listened to Bloomberg Radio. I think they have some great guests on there. And they were talking to someone from the shipping industry and the fact that they had a mandate to lower sulfur emissions in shipping ships by 80%. So that's their mandate. They have to do this. And so they weren't taxed, and the money wasn't taken from them. It was given to government to solve the problem. What they were given a mandate to lower it. And it was a mandate that they could achieve, so there was a negotiation. It wasn't a mandate from way out in left field saying, well, you're going to do this, and the industry says, well, that's impossible. It was a negotiated mandate. And so what they did was, what's going to happen is, the fuel that they're going to buy now for the ships is going to be the low sulfur fuel, a little bit more cost. That's going to be spread throughout the whole food supply chain. Second thing is, they're going to have scrubbers attached to certain ships so that you can scrub the sulfur out, so a way to mitigate pollution. And third is, they're going to make the ships a little bit more aerodynamic and slow them down, kind of like when we had the 55 mile per hour speed limit to get use less fuel. And so using that combination of approaches, a true market-based approach is taken, letting people who do the work on a daily basis solve the problem. So when you talk about free markets, capitalism, you're talking about local control. You're talking about the people who live there, who are doing the work, figuring out the problem. Government can set a reasonable standard to help you achieve that and negotiate, maybe throw you some carrots instead of beating you with a stick. But that's the way we're going to solve these problems. It's not going to be by taking the resources away from the industries that want to modify and change, make it so they can't do the work here, and sending it out to high polluting places, either other states or other countries. So again, this is the approach that we hear. So any other comments on that, Jim?
Well, I'll throw in another example. You know, we have a major trucking manufacturer, and just to highlight that these things are happening, and this R&D is happening, and there's testing of these platooning systems for trucks that increase the aerodynamic features and to reduce fuel consumption on trucking, and that work is happening here in Oregon, and yet it's another response in the carbon debate that's happening because the marketplace demands it, because it's good business. You don't necessarily need the government to come in and extract wealth, which I think your point was really good. It takes away the margins that you would use to reinvest back into your company and your control technologies. And so it really does create, I think, perverse incentives for growth and even implementing those technologies that would help.
Thank you very much. Well, that'll do it for this edition of Oregon Crossroads. JL has been a fabulous guest, and I'd encourage each and every one of you to contact your legislator, your local representative, and say that we want a clean environment. We want to lower carbon. We want to do it in a way that enhances our freedom and prosperity and makes sense, and work with our business allies. Work with them. Thank you very much and have a great day.